Where oil comes from?
Where oil comes from.
Oh my God, okay.
Oil.
In the Middle East?
I believe the Middle East.
Middle East.
From underneath the earth?
Texas.
Definitely the Middle East.
Probably Africa.
I also understand there's some oil here in the United States of America.
The way I understand it is oil, it's a fossil fuel, so it's...
I know a lot of countries that America sources oil from, but I'm not sure where exactly it comes from.
From fossils, of fossilized, dinosaurs and the like.
Dinosaurs and the like. Yeah. Those dinosaurs and plants and bits of life from millions of years ago power so much of our economy and our lives in the form of oil. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. Right now, something remarkable is happening. The price of a barrel of oil has fallen by more than half this year. This week alone, it's bounced around so much that prices are at their most volatile in two decades. In part, the low prices are because OPEC, the oil cartel, decided not to cut production last fall. And in part because, well, so many places are producing oil that there's just a lot of it. And of course, there's that Chinese economic slowdown that we talked about last week. So today, we've got an in-depth examination of oil, where it fits into our lives, and what those low prices mean. For countries, like Russia, where the economy is tightly tied to oil. For people, who've made their livelihoods in oil fields and on pipelines. For U.S. political and economic fights. And for a lot of us, every day, where the price of gas influences our behavior and what we do.
The price of gas, how does it affect me?
It affects how I drive. I am considerate where I go because I need to save my gas.
It's affected my car purchase. I bought a diesel engine because the price of diesel is much cheaper.
Yeah, I mean, I have to put it in the Prius. Obviously, if I had my choice, I wouldn't use it in any way, shape, or form, but there's no real way around that at this point, unfortunately.
You heard those drivers just now, and Labor Day weekend gas prices are the lowest they've been in 11 years. The thing is, about 80% of the price of gas depends on the price of oil. And oil prices, well, they're not as easy to calculate as you might think. This week, oil bounced around near $44 a barrel. To understand how the heck that price is set, we've got Marketplace's Scott Tong from our sustainability desk. Welcome back.
Good to talk to you. Nice to be back.
All right, let's upset all those economic laws of supply and demand. Not completely, but
okay.
Will you explain to me how setting the price of oil is more complicated?
Well, it is crazy complicated. As soon as you had me prepare for this, my brain started to spin as I did research. But let's talk about this. Supply and demand, it's mostly supply and demand, right? How much oil is in the market in the world and how many of us want to buy it? And then there's a negotiation and there's a price and we work off that price. But here's the however, that the interesting part is it's not just oil sellers and oil users who are in the market, right? We have all these other market participants who don't touch the stuff at all. Hmm. And sometimes they're known as the evil speculators, right? These are investors, these are hedge funds, etc. And so especially when prices swing wildly, they contribute to that. If they think, oh, you know what? OPEC just decided they're going to pump a lot more oil. They're like, well, there's going to be a glut. And prices are going to go down. So we're going to anticipate prices going down. And so they can contribute to this herd, right, which is more than just the physical supply and demand. But speculators have this terrible name, right? We always want to blame them when something happens. This is the trade-off that we make with speculators in the market is very often they serve a great function in the market. That is, if I'm buying and the prices are going all over the place and I want to buy at a certain price next December, you know, just so I can lock it in, I might not always find somebody out there. But if you have all these speculators, you have all these market participants, and I'm going to be able to find somebody to be on the other side of that trade. Similarly, if I'm selling.
So really more buyers and sellers.
Yeah. It's more of a crowded market. You have more participants. And if I'm a buyer or a seller, it just makes it that much easier for me to find somebody to take what I'm offering at a certain price. And in those cases, they're kind of these financial market superheroes. At other times, they're part of the herd, and we get to blame them a lot for, you know, these big violent swings in the market.
Can you explain to me what is baked into the price of oil from the moment it comes out of the ground till it reaches those charts that you see on a trading floor pit?
Okay. So, right, you have underground these compressed dinosaurs, plants, right, that are underground there. And, you know, there's a lot of hydrogen and a lot of carbon, so they're hydrocarbons. And we find them and we dig them up. Well, there are a lot of people who are involved in bringing that to the places, to the place where it's traded, and they make a bunch of money along the way, right? You have these geologists who look down there and can find it with these fancy x-rays. You have, of course, the drillers and the drill rig operators. You have bankers who finance all of this stuff. And then after you drill it, you may have to deliver it through a pipeline or by barge or by truck. Those are all people who get some of that money in addition to whoever owns that land. It's mostly private property here in the United States. And, of course, there are taxes. So you have the state and the federal government in some cases taking some of that money too. So when a barrel of oil is sold effectively, a whole lot of people see some of that money because, you know, that molecule, that hydrocarbon, has taken a pretty long trip along the way and everybody gets a cut.
You have also talked to me about the concept of inelasticity. What is that and how does it work?
Inelasticity is, it explains a lot of how prices are so volatile. So if you go back to Thanksgiving when OPEC said, you know, surprise, we're going to drill more oil into the world. There's going to be an oversupply. Well, oil markets don't react very quickly to that. So if there's more, right? If we take the Tong household, we have a lot of soccer car pools, right? But if there's more oil on the market, I'm not going to drive more car pools, right? If my car can take 15 gallons, that 16th gallon, it means nothing to me, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the 16th piece of cheesecake means a lot to me, but the 16th gallon of oil means nothing to me. And that's the problem. And so you have all these sellers saying, anybody want oil? You want oil? How about it was at 100? How about 90? How about 80? How about 40? So that's what happens when markets just don't adjust very quickly, and they call it inelasticity. It also works on the supply side. If demand really goes up, it's not like the suppliers can just flip a switch and say, boom, you know, oil. There's a long runway in order to produce it. And because, you know, the buyers and the sellers are kind of locked in, they're not very flexible. They're not very elastic. And that helps to explain why prices go crazy sometimes in the oil markets.
Marketplace's Scott Tong from our sustainability desk. Thank you, Scott.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. We just heard a breakdown of the price of oil and what makes it move. Now we're going to hear from someone whose life is at the mercy of that price, where he lives and where he works, and how secure his future will be all depend on oil. Maheshwar Goldekar has been working in the oil business for over 20 years in Nigeria and Kuwait and now China, where he joined us by phone from the middle of a pipeline project. I asked him how he ended up there.
Most of the oil industries are going down, and there is no work coming up in Nigeria. So they have asked us to move out because there are no new projects coming up in Nigeria. And now there are a few projects going on across the world, so which I had to go wherever the work is there. So I had to find a new job. So I shifted to China.
It sounds like you're sort of chasing the places where oil still gets a decent price. Is that right?
There are no decent price of the oil, but I'm thinking that there will be no more jobs left over in oil and gas industries. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, because there are no new projects coming up because of the oil prices are very, very low. It's around $45. And I don't think so there are new projects coming up.
So this low price of oil, what has this done for you and your job prospects?
Really speaking, the job is going to end soon and we'll be laid off soon. So I don't know what I'm going to do once I go back, and I had to start another business or look in the other industries for the job, not in oil and gas. So the oil prices has brought me down to more less than 50% whatever I was earning before. So
really less than 50% of what you were earning when?
When I was in Nigeria, I had to accept the pay cut of 20%. And now there is no job, so we had to accept whatever the job gives us. So that's the way it is.
How do you feel about the future?
Future, it depends on the oil prices. If it doesn't go up, the industry will not able to cope up with it, with the oil prices. So maybe, unless and until the oil prices goes up, we'll not able to move on. And we had to shift from oil and gas business to some other industry like fertilizers or downstream products in refinery or something. So I'm not sure about my future. So I'm not at all. Yeah.
How long have you been working in oil and gas?
I have been working in oil and gas more than 20 years now. Almost 22 years in oil and gas, and previously I was in petrochemicals. So it was like 27 years together.
And is this the kind of most worried you've been about finding another job?
Yeah, that is a big worry because we are experts in oil and gas. We know in and out of oil and gas industry, so once you go for a new job, you have to start it again. I don't know. It may take time or something. And it's a time for retirement.
Wow, that sounds kind of scary.
Yeah, it's scary. It's scary for me, my family, everything. Yeah.
Moeshwar Guldikar, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure being with you. Yeah, thank you.
Now let's look at some of the biggest numbers in the news this week. Every day, Marketplace's By the Numbers blog tracks them and posts them at marketplace.org. Here's digital producer Tony Wagner and Marketplace weekend producer Raghu Manavalan with a look at some of the other economic stories of the week by the numbers. Our first number,
35 million.
That's how many hours of movie trailers have been watched on YouTube.
What, like in forever?
In the first 6 months of this year, and that's just on smartphones. With all the different kinds of previews out there, trailers have become an industry in and of themselves.
$12.
That's how much you'll have to pay per month for Hulu's new commercial-free subscription.
The move puts the streaming service in line with competitors like Netflix, Amazon, and HBO Go.
But it actually doesn't apply to every show. You'll still have to watch ads in front of Scandal, New Girl, and five other shows.
495.
That's the average reading score for students who took the SAT this year.
That's the lowest number it's been since 1972.
And the mean math score was 511. Hasn't been that low since 99.
Ugh.
Oh, you think you could do better?
I mean, I don't know. I could probably do a little
better.
All right,
well, okay. What do you get when you divide the hypotenuse by pi?
I don't think that's actual math, Tony.
Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology. This is Tech in Real Life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Hi, Ben.
Hello, Lizzie.
We're going to talk about how tech intersects with the oil world today. And first, let's talk a little bit about price, which we talked about earlier in the show, but technology does have an effect on, I guess we should say, how quickly oil prices are set.
Absolutely. So there's a larger thing that's been happening in the markets in the last decade or so, Lizzie, and this is that traders, human and robotic, can be less connected to the fundamentals of the actual things being traded. So we also have this growth in high frequency and, or you could call it algorithmic trading, essentially trades being made by computers. And what that means is that trades happen faster and at higher volume. So there's more intensity there. there when a swing happens. You know, people might be worried about political instability in the Middle East, for example. And even though the headlines aren't necessarily always directly connected to the actual oil supply, machines and people that drive those machines could drive a bunch of futures trading that has an impact on the price and can make it swing kind of intensely in one direction or another.
So we're really talking about amplification here.
Absolutely. Amplification driven in a lot of ways by computers and computer trading.
There's another big change that's happening driven by computers in the oil world. And
yes,
we're going to talk about the D word, drones.
Drones, or unmanned aerial vehicles, as it were, Lizzie. Yes, this is more exciting to me, at least, I think, in terms of a change. There's this interesting example of how drones are starting to be used by actually oil companies. Oil companies, as you can imagine, are often at the forefront of physical technology involved in things like extraction, for example. And the reason is that oil, it's hard to find. It's hard to transport. It's difficult to refine. We often find this stuff in remote places, the bottom of the ocean, the side of a mountain range. Even once a company finds and sets up shop, the area is still remote. Also, maybe there's not a lot of roads to get there. And drones are part of this.
So how do drones work in those sort of scenarios?
Something that's already happening is the first commercial drone permits that have been given out by the Federal Aviation Administration have gone to the likes of BP and ConocoPhillips. Drones are already being used in Alaska, North Dakota, rural Virginia. They're traveling both over the ocean and over land. And there's actually this drone called the Puma, for instance, that has high-definition cameras, even infrared sensors on it. And it's all about taking information and data.
What are the drones doing?
Okay, so for now, oil companies are using groups of drones in so-called unmanned aerial systems to do surveys and collect data generally. But in the near future, you can imagine a lot of oil companies using drones to inspect a pipeline, for instance, or inspect a drill site to make sure things are going okay. Maybe if there's a problem, you know, maybe a rupture in a pipeline, for instance, a drone could help companies discover or identify something before a larger environmental disaster might happen, for instance. But also, drones could be used by government to ensure compliance. So imagine an inspection agency that could fly a drone in the air near maybe a smokestack and make sure that the company that owns that smokestack is complying with environmental requirements. In some cases, that might be easier for government agencies to do. Of course, there are big questions here too, Lizzie, right? I mean, drones can offer their own form of pollution. Already this year, the number of drone sightings by human pilots has doubled, and the year's not over yet, right? Doubled over last year. So we need to figure out how to regulate the use of drones themselves. But of course, that's probably for another conversation.
So we'll bring you back on to have it. Ben Johnson, the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you, Lizzie.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. On the show today, we are deep in oil. Well, theoretically, anyway. And Russia has an economy that's linked hand in hand with oil. About half the government's revenue comes from oil. And the fall in crude prices, plus economic sanctions over Ukraine and a weak ruble, have pushed the country into recession. Russia's economy shrank 4.6% in the second quarter. To get a sense of how that feels in everyday life, we're joined by Yuri Vendik in Moscow. He's with the BBC's Russian service. I asked him what the crisis looks like there.
I think most picturesque thing is the real estate market, because, say, 2 years ago, you could rent a very small one-bedroom flat in the Moscow outskirts for at least for 35,000 rubles, and that was around $1,000 at that time. And now you can rent the same small flat, but in the center of Moscow for the same money, and that money is around $600 at this moment. So that's the effect of the crisis and the ruble rate combined.
Wow.
And then, of course, that is very good for people like me, for foreigners who have to rent flats here in Moscow. And now I can walk. I just rented a flat, and now I can walk to the office for the first time, from my home to the office for the first time in my life. And then the price hike. The official inflation rate is not very high. It's around 16 or 17% for the last year. But the so-called inflation for the poor, that is food prices, petrol prices, and so on, that is much higher, and everyone can feel that. The food in the shops is say at least 50%. That's my feeling, but at least 50% more expensive than say a year ago.
Are there things that have turned into luxuries that used to be staples?
Well, as you may know, Russia have introduced so-called counter sanctions against Western food. And some of the food like cheese, like milk products from Europe and the US and Australia and so on are now prohibited in Russia. Some of them are still brought into, still imported into Russia under the labels of, say, Serbia or Belarusia or other countries. They just put different stickers on the food. But that all resulted in a very serious price hike. Ordinary, normal cheese is now unaffordable for the most of the Russians, I believe. And, some other things as well.
Is there a sense, do you think, among regular people, how tied this is to oil? Or do they see it more as a product of the government's budget?
Well, the funny thing here is that very many people are influenced by the Russian propaganda, and they think that that is the result of, Western policy towards Russia. Although that is actually the result of the effect of the crisis and the effect of the oil price drop, and then only third thing is the sanctions that the West applies to Russia.
I've seen reports of several Russians who can afford to are leaving the country because the economy is in such rough shape right now. Is that something that you see?
Yes, we can see that, but there are not many Russians who can afford moving abroad. We can see many Russians, many oppositioners fleeing abroad because of the repressions, and that's what I can say for sure. There are hundreds for now. As for the economic migrants, we can see people... Yeah, by the way, the migrant workers from the Central Asia, very many of them, hundreds of thousands of them, as we can see from the statistics and from the streets of Moscow, they left because of ruble rate. It doesn't make sense for them anymore to earn money here in Russia.
An executive from Lukoil was quoted a few days ago essentially saying, if there's positive thinking, oil prices will go back up, things will be okay. Is there a sense among the Russian people that there is a plan to reverse some of the problems that have been overtaking the Russian economy?
Yes, but at least they hope so. And it is very clear from the Putin speeches that he hopes very much for the price of oil to go back to the heights. It used to be a year and a half ago, but the economists say that there's no way. Economists here in Russia, they agree upon that is this level of the prices of the oil prices is for quite a long time will stay with us for quite a long time. So the sense here is that the authorities and Putin himself then don't have any say solid plan, strategic plan, let's say.
Yuri Vendik with the BBC Russian Service in Moscow. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We wanted to take a step back from oil right now and look at how oil became so critical to our economy. When a lot of people think about our history with oil, they might first think of the Arab oil embargo of 1973. Indeed, you heard all those people talk about the Middle East at the top of the show. But our country's troubled love affair with oil is much older and much deeper, and in a lot of ways is the story of American empire.
Tyler Priest is an associate professor of history and geography at the University of Iowa, where he studies oil and gas. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Give me what you'd say are the maybe top three moments in the U.S. history with oil that we should understand.
The 1859 discovery of oil in Titusville as the origin of the U.S. industry, so most stories about oil start there.
The place is Titusville, Pennsylvania. Hey, you see that makeshift drilling rig over there? It's not drilling for water, mister. It's drilling for oil. It was put there by Colonel Edwin L. Drake. He learned that oil could be refined into kerosene. See, he was going to give them whale oil fellers a run for their money.
I think the first decade of the 20th century is critical as oil moved to Texas, the 1901 discovery of the great Spindletop oil field near Beaumont, Texas, sort of shifted the focus from Pennsylvania and Ohio down to Texas, Oklahoma, Louisiana, which are have become the largest oil-producing states. Texas also had antitrust laws that kept Standard Oil out.
This court determines against the Standard Oil Trust on account of its unreasonable business practices, which are in violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act. The Standard Oil Trust must be broken up within 6 months.
And so that provided room for new companies to emerge and more competition. I also think that people don't often mention what some people call the third oil shock, which was 1985, 1986, when oil prices collapsed.
They're not drilling an oil well. Today they were plugging one. It only produces 2 barrels a day and would cost $20,000 to repair. That's not economical at today's oil prices.
And that's probably the best analog we have for what's happening today, because the oil industry had experienced this 10-year period of prosperity, even though a lot of their concessions were nationalized. But high oil prices spurred a frenzy of drilling in the United States. And then Saudi Arabia did what they're doing today, which is jacking up their production and retaking market share and driving the price of oil down. And there was a huge shakeout in the American oil industry.
You wrote this sentence: the control of oil also helped elevate the United States as the supreme global power. What does that mean exactly? How did that relationship take place?
Oil is a versatile substance. You know, we use it for gasoline, we refine it and turn it into all sorts of other products. But it was critical in warfare, beginning with World War I and then certainly World War II. World War II was won on the basis of American strength and British strength in controlling oil. And in many cases, the objectives in World War II were over control of oil. And the United States and Great Britain emerged from World War II as the victors with the largest control over oil. The seven major oil companies, sometimes referred to as the Seven Sisters, were all American and British companies.
How do you think the embargo shifted the way Americans think about oil now?
The oil shocks, I guess if we call them that, the first oil shock in 1970, the embargo and the quadrupling of oil prices certainly made Americans aware of oil in a way that they hadn't been before. Oil has always been kind of invisible. It was cheap, about $2 to $3 a barrel from 1950 to 1970.
Our position must be clear. I am ordering that we discontinue purchasing of any oil from Iran for delivery to this country.
We just took it for granted that it was cheap and easy to get and will always be available. And the embargo and the price increases and then ultimately the nationalization of American ownership of Middle Eastern resources made this a major geopolitical issue and a major issue for consumers. We had a series of policies enacted in the 70s to shift away from oil and reduce our consumption. And they did go a long ways. I mean, I think one thing people don't realize is that we consume the same amount of oil today, around 18 to 19 million barrels a day, that we did in 1979, despite the fact that our population and the size of the U.S. economy in real terms both have doubled over that time.
Looking at this with an historian's eye, where would the United States be without oil?
Gosh, that's hard to answer because almost everything about our society is saturated with oil. Not only our cars, not only, you know, our transportation, but, you know, we heat our homes, we power our transportation. Almost all of our consumer items are produced from petrochemicals, plastics and synthetics, in clothes and furniture. And almost, you look around and almost everything we use is made from oil.
Tyler Priest, Associate Professor of History and Geography at the University of Iowa. Thank you.
My pleasure.
There are a lot of places oil ends up that you might not realize. Face cream, shampoo, plastic bottles. And right now, the price of oil is so low that it's cheaper to make new plastic bottles than recycle old ones, which can really hurt recycling businesses. Just last quarter, the company Waste Management, which is the biggest waste hauler in the U.S., lost $59 million because of the drop in recycling revenue. I spoke to Waste Management's CEO, David Steiner, and said, hey, that's a lot of lost money, even for you.
Yeah, and it's frankly, that's been happening to us now for the last 3 years. You know, the recycling markets are interesting. In the history of recycling markets, going back to the early 90s, you've had a couple dips, and they've been very short-term dips. They're at most 2-3 months. Even in the Great Recession of 2009, we had a dramatic downturn, but it only lasted 4 months. This is the first time that we've seen commodity markets down for, you know, 3+ years. And, you know, Lizzie, I think people say, well, gosh, we're surprised by that. But take a look at oil prices. Take a look at copper prices. Take a look at all the commodity prices throughout the world, and you'll see the same pattern that for the last 3 years, it's been a down pattern. And for folks that play in the commodity business, it's a struggle. And the recycling business is, at its core, a commodity business.
Is this all due to oil?
No. You know, when we look at recycling, there's really three major components to recycling. Fiber, so cardboard, newspapers, office paper, and then metals, and then plastics. And so fiber is driven mainly by the domestic mills in China's demand. They'll use the fiber to create cardboard boxes that they use to ship goods throughout the world. And so when you've seen worldwide and Chinese GDP slipping in the last couple of years, demand for fiber has been reduced. And as you know, demand for newsprint has been reduced. So the fiber demand has been down a bit. On metals, you know, you've seen all metals from aluminum to copper to steel. You've seen those prices down over the last few years. And then oil really does affect plastic for us. You know, the PET that goes into your plastic water bottles is a derivative of oil. And when oil's at $40 to $50 a barrel, it's cheaper to use virgin material than to use recycled material. And so you've actually seen demand for recycled PET, plastic bottles, you've seen that demand drop precipitously over the last 18 months. And so, you know, it's really commodities across the board that have affected our recycling business.
Well, walk me through for a consumer who probably thinks of recycling as just what they do with their trash at the end of the day. How does falling oil impact your business and particularly your recycling business?
Yeah, you know, when you look at our business, it's really pretty simple. It's like any business. You've got a cost that we have to collect and process the material. So we have to send trucks out to pick up the material. We then have to process that material to separate the plastic from the cardboard, from the metals. And then we sell the materials on the back end. What's happened in the recycling business is really twofold. The collection and processing costs have actually gone up dramatically. And that's because of the proliferation of recycling throughout the United States. Folks now have the option of putting all of their recyclable materials in one bin. We were the pioneers in developing that. And it drove recycling rates way up. It certainly helped to get more material into the recycling stream. The problem is we haven't done the corresponding job of educating consumers of what can go into that bin. And so we're seeing more and more contamination in our recycling material, which drives our processing costs up. So our processing costs go up, and then what we can sell the material on the back end, what we can sell it for, goes down, And so what you've seen in our business from peak to trough is about a $200 million difference in earnings in recycling. And you can imagine, when you have a $200 million drop in earnings from recycling, guess what you do? You stop investing in recycling. At the peak, we invested upwards of $400 million a year in recycling. Today, we're investing virtually nothing.
How many plants have you had to shut down?
We've shut down about 10, and we've got another 6 or 7 that we're looking at over the next year. But the shutting down is one thing. The lack of investment is really the big thing, right? I mean, you're seeing plants shut down throughout the United States, and that is alarming. But the fact that there aren't a lot of plants being opened is just as alarming. If, as a country and certainly as a company, Waste Management believes that recycling is good for our environment, if we as a country believe that, we need to do something to make sure that this infrastructure not only doesn't go away, but that we continue to build it to get recycling rates higher and higher. And every year it's gone up until the last year that the EPA reported. It actually slightly went down. And so if we want to see that happen, there's got to be investments in infrastructure. And if there's going to be an investment in infrastructure, we've got to understand how we can make it profitable so that private businesses will continue to invest.
If you've had to shut down 10 plants, how many people have lost their jobs?
Gosh, our typical recycling plant will employ anywhere from sort of 50 to 100 people. You know, a lot of it's automated. And so, you know, when we're shutting down those plants, you're absolutely right. It is a hit to that local economy. And so I think it's a great way to look at it. This is not just something that's good for the environment. This is something that's good for employment in the United States. And to the extent that we see recycling rates going down, you're absolutely right. It not only has an environmental cost, it has a human cost.
I've heard you use the word crisis in interviews. Is it that bad?
Well, look, my definition of a crisis is looking out into the future and seeing a future where recycling rates are going down. I view that as a crisis. You know, some people might say, well, we're still recycling 25%, and maybe that's a good thing. I don't view that as a good thing. I view that as a crisis. You know, what we're trying to do is to help drive recycling rates up, not down. So, is it going to dramatically affect the earnings at Waste Management? Absolutely not. From a recycling perspective, from the environment's perspective, I think we're staring down the face of a crisis that if we don't do something about it today, it might not be a crisis today, but if we don't do something about it soon, it's going to be a crisis, and it's going to be a crisis soon into the future.
David Steiner, President and CEO of Waste Management, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. We've talked this hour about the price of oil, the lives changed by it economically. There are, of course, environmental costs, not just a warming climate, but what happens when something goes terribly wrong? Just listen to this TV reporter.
Up to 40 million gallons of oil have gushed into the Gulf of Mexico.
Oh, yeah. That TV reporter? That's me. 5 years ago on the beach in Grand Isle, Louisiana, during the BP oil spill. The Coast Guard flew me up and over the site of the spill, and it was pretty staggering. You can hear us on the plane's headsets.
There's a little bit here of a line we're overflying right now. That's oil.
Oh, yeah, right there.
The ribbons of oil were orange in some places, rainbow in others, and they stretched for miles and miles. That spill lasted 87 days. More than 3 million barrels of oil were spilled. And that eclipsed what had been the biggest U.S. spill before that, the Exxon Valdez in Prince William Sound. Former Alaskan fisherman Joe Banta remembers that moment in 1989.
When the spill happened, I was waking up listening to NPR. Over the radio, I heard that they'd run the tanker aground, and I swore and said that the captain must have been drunk. I worked for a small fishermen's association back then, and went into work and started gathering information, and pretty quickly realized the magnitude of what was going on. My friends in Cordova, where I grew up.
Banta says the fishing stock has rebounded since then, but it took years to recover from the 257,000-barrel spill. And then there are the less publicized stories, like those from the Enbridge spill in Michigan, where a pipeline leak spilled onto Frank Zinn's family farm in 2010.
So all 850,000 gallons of crude oil that spilled got out of ground zero, actually flowed through our property. I think we all need to recognize that we need the safety infrastructure in place to make sure these spills don't happen.
You just heard Frank Zinn talk about a pipeline spill on his family farm. Pipelines carrying oil and natural gas crisscross the U.S. There are more than 190,000 miles of them, according to the American Petroleum Institute. And since the fight over the Keystone XL pipeline, they are increasingly controversial. To talk pipelines, we've got Matt Daly. He works at Politico Pro, where he's the energy and transportation editor and joins us from their newsroom. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I think most of our listeners are pretty familiar by now with the Keystone Pipeline fight. What other pipelines, though, are out there and being debated right now?
Well, there's a lot of them, actually. Probably one that people in the Northeast are most familiar with might be the Northeast Energy Direct Pipeline. That's one that would take gas from the Marcellus Shale in Pennsylvania up to the Boston area. Another one down here near Washington that's got some attention is the Dominion Atlantic Coast Pipeline. That's one that would take natural gas from West Virginia, the same Marcellus Shale formation, down into North Carolina, across Virginia. There's a lot of other smaller pipelines that are also getting a lot of attention in the local press. I live in New Jersey that's got a couple that have triggered some fights, but pretty much every pipeline around the country right now that's under construction is getting some attention from the local community.
You guys have done some reporting on sort of the Keystone effect on environmentalists, activists, and people who live in various communities. You know, is there a playbook that they have followed watching the opposition to Keystone, do you think?
Yeah, there seem to be some more and more groups that are getting involved in this. It used to be just really a local NIMBY issue. If a big company came along and wanted to dig up your property, that sort of got the attention of the local groups, but the local landowners. But now what you're seeing is environmental groups, climate change activists, all these people are looking at the infrastructure build-out, and they're saying, you know, we can help push back on this. We can lobby. We can use some of the legal strategies that we've used in other places, and we can sort of build a grassroots movement and challenge this at various levels.
You know, one of the ironies of this, I mean, you cover transportation as well. Do you think there's a case to be made that these oil companies, if they can't move crude or natural gas via pipeline, that they're just going to put it on trucks and transport it? I mean, is it going to move one way or the other?
Well, that's what the industry says, and the economics seem to have justified that so far. I mean, when the price of oil is high, there's a lot of the stuff that's moving on trucks, that's moving on trains, moving all around the country in places where it hadn't really gone before. That sort of, you know, raises some eyebrows, but it shows that the markets can be very efficient. They'll find a way to get the product to market when they need to.
Yeah, when you look going forward, what do you think the future of pipelines is going to be?
Well, it's a subsection of the country's infrastructure problem in general. You know, we need highways to get around. We need railroads to help ship products around. And oil and gas pipelines are really a part of what's been a crucial part of what's been the boom in energy production in this country. 10 years ago, there were a lot of questions around whether or not the U.S. had enough natural gas to keep meeting the demand that was there at the time. Well, now that situation has completely changed. To get that gas from the places where it sits underground, it's going to require a huge investment, billions, tens of billions of dollars, perhaps hundreds of billions of dollars in pipelines. The same with the oil that's coming out of North Dakota now, that's coming out of Western Canada. If that energy is going to reach market, it's going to need a highway system of pipelines that can transport it around the country.
One of the things I found very interesting in your reporting is that the opposition, certainly, and the local groups opposed to some of these pipelines does not seem to break along traditional political lines. You certainly have members of the GOP and former Bush administration official working against, say, some of the pipelines in the Northeast.
Each pipeline is kind of its own story, but and the one in the Dominion pipeline running along the Atlantic coast is particular runs through some very Republican areas of the of the state. And, you know, that's pretty much a NIMBY issue right there. They're looking at what's a, you know, a very treasured local landscape, and to have a big company come in and tear that up to put a pipeline down makes people nervous. That's really the sort of the age-old NIMBY issue. We know we need this stuff, but we don't want it in our backyard. For other people, the issue can become, you know, it can be a bigger issue. It can be an anti-fracking sentiment, or it can be a climate change, anti-fossil fuel type of a sentiment. Whatever it is, you know, all these forces seem to be combined into one these days, and it's making it very difficult to get new pipelines built.
Matt Daly, Energy and Transportation Editor at Politico Pro, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. Throughout the show, we've brought you stories of countries, businesses, and people whose lives have been touched or changed by oil. We're going to end with Kendra Hill. She and her husband moved to North Dakota following the Bakken oil boom. Here she is talking with reporter Todd Melby from part of his series, Black Gold Boom.
I'm Kendra Hill. I used to live in Northwest Washington. There was no money. We made barely minimum wage, and we couldn't keep up on anything when it was just me and my husband. So we moved out here, and it's a lot better. We're on our second new house now. We just built a house and actually afford to live, not scrape by. We would never have had kids in Washington. We couldn't afford just the two of us, but now we could afford kids and still not be scraping by. Hannah is 2.5. Donnie here is 5.5 months. He's our angel child at the moment, but he's still a baby, so we'll see how that goes. My husband, he is a warehouse supervisor. He mixes up the chemicals, the waters, and the sands to send out to the fracking sites, and he's currently making $26 an hour, so double what he was making in Washington. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's nice.
So are you all worried about the price of oil dropping or getting laid off?
No, he's high enough up, and he's the longest employee they've had at his branch of his job. We're making maybe 2/3 of what we made before, because they cut back the overtime. So if you're not doing anything for an hour, they send you home. So it's kind of a pain, but we're still making the money, so it's what's important. Before I moved up here with my husband, I got on Google Maps to see what the town was like, and all I could see was dust. I went on the street view, and I saw a few little shops from Main Street, and all I could see was the dust clouds. And now you can go on Google Maps and you'll actually see shops and Famous Dave's. We've got Culver's. We've got Fuddruckers. Yep, I think there's enough businesses here we could sustain a town. In my opinion, I think we could. This is our home and this is where we're staying forever, even if the oil field leaves. So we bought a house and this is our home now.
And that's our show for this week. Next week, we'll be exploring borders and what they mean in our lives. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Jenny Ament and Raghu Manavalan. Golda Arthur was our senior producer this week, and Jeff Peters is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.